This is the greatest podcast. At Greatest, we bring you interviews with leading minds in fitness, health, and happiness, as well as some of our best tips, all of which are backed by verifiable PubMed studies. A greatest is someone who makes better choices in order to improve fitness, health, and happiness. So ask yourself, are you a greatest?
Hey friends, welcome back to the Greatest Podcast. I'm Matt Gartland. I'm here today with Nick English, my co-host, and a super amazing show ahead of us today. We have Brad Pilon on the show. Brad is a nutritionist and bodybuilder, and he literally wrote the book on intermittent fasting called Eat, Stop, Eat, which takes a very zen approach, actually, to kind of a controversial topic. Brad came to intermittent fasting while in graduate school after a few years in research and development for a major nutritional supplement company, and has continued to evolve writings and project his experience on the subject, along with other folks in the industry like Martin Beckham from Lean Gains. So Brad is a true thought leader in the space. It's a really important element to a healthy lifestyle overall, intermittent fasting. So Brad, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
So I've experimented a little bit with intermittent fasting. I actually find it very fascinating from a scientific standpoint and evolving that into like a lifestyle practice.
Yeah.
But I wonder, for someone maybe coming to a healthy lifestyle decision for the first time, not really informed on intermittent fasting, how do you go about kind of instructing someone on what that concept is?
How about we start with the real general idea of why do we eat? And why do we eat when we eat? Why do we eat what we eat? And we really very quickly come to the conclusion that most of how we eat today in sort of the involved industrialized society is we eat out of habit. Right, we eat at certain times of the day, certain things with certain people, and it's almost exclusively habit-driven. Now, those habits may be externally influenced by media or marketing or you know, societal norms, but they're habits, right? So scrambled eggs in the morning, breakfast cereal in the morning, you know, that's habit. And if someone sits down to a bowl of, I don't know, broccoli and sweet potatoes in the morning, that's weird, because it's different, but it's also not part of the sort of the general consensus of what the right habit is. You go to certain places for certain types of food or coffee, you know, like everything is habit driven. And once you get people to understand that and realize that what we're going to try to do is examine these habits and break some of these habits and get back to the point where you really eat whenever you want to, as you see fit, it opens up the door to taking larger and larger breaks from eating. And a great way to explore those habits and to explore the concept of taking a break from eating is to simply take 24 hours between 2 days, stop eating, you know, effectively fast, and at that time examine when are you getting hungry or when are you craving certain foods and why. And so when you take that approach, this learning approach, it's very easy to get people to try a fast. And then what will happen is two things. They learn a lot about why they eat, but they also nail off a 24-hour fast relatively easily. And then you come back to them and be like, by the way, like, you know, you just did a massive calorie cut. You just did a lot of things that are probably good for your body during this break. How did it feel? And if you take that approach, it's very easy to get people into the concept of intermittent fasting as opposed to the scare tactic of, okay, you're going to not eat for the next 24 hours. It's going to be tough, but it's going to be awesome because you're going to lose some fat. You know, that can be intimidating to a lot of people. But when you view it as an experiment on eating as opposed to an experiment on fasting, it's very simple to get people to open up and try it.
Yeah, I mean, I think examining habits is like a hugely important component of health and nutrition. And then one of the wonderful side effects of intermittent fasting is clearly the large caloric deficit that people wind up with at the end of a 24-hour fast. But I think a lot of the momentum behind the intermittent fasting movement is a lot of the benefits that come from taking a break from food. So this is hormonal benefits that are related to insulin and growth hormone. Could you go over those a little bit for us?
Yeah, well, what happens during a fast is, for the average healthy human, what happens during a fast is exactly what is supposed to happen during a fast, which is your body recognizes that there's little substrates coming in from your food. You haven't eaten in a while, so there's no energy being provided by food. And so it turns to external stores. And those external stores are your body fat. The time while that shift takes place, some rather fascinating hormonal changes occur where you actually move from a fed state metabolism or a metabolism that's primary goal is the proper handling of the calories and nutrients from food. You move to a fed state metabolism, which primary goal is the liberation of energy from your energy stores. And that whole transition, it's this beautifully orchestrated thing that involves the slow but steady decrease in insulin in your body, which is primarily your storage hormone, to really kind of diminish it into one title. At the same time, you see a slow but steady increase in your growth hormone, which I still to this day think is misnamed and should have been called fasting hormone, because while it is involved in growth in children, over the lifetime of a human, one of its main goals or main jobs is the overseeing the appropriate liberation of energy from your fat, the proper release of fat from your fat stores to be used as an energy source. So you have this decrease in insulin, this increase in growth hormone, this increase in free fatty acids, which are the, the release form of fat from your body fat. Then they all orchestrate together to preserve your muscle mass, to maintain your blood glucose at a nice stable level because you start burning free fatty acids instead. It's this wonderful cascade of events that makes it relatively unnoticeable that you're moving into this fasted state. Yet by the end of anywhere from a 16 to 24 hour fast, you're burning almost exclusively body fat as a fuel source. And you've made the switch from burning, the mix of food you ate 24 hours ago. You switched from doing that all the way over to burning body fat as a fuel. And it's been, a relatively comfortable process. You haven't really known it's happening. And this is all to do with how easily and fluidly your body can make that switch and adjust these hormones. It's really fascinating thing.
Wait a minute, Brad. If I don't go 2 hours without a meal, then my metabolism is going to shut down, right? I mean,
shut down completely. Yeah, no heartbeat, no pulse, no metabolism whatsoever. And that was one of the main areas of my research when I first started on this whole fasting, trip, this journey, was I was exploring all the bad things that happened to your metabolism when you didn't eat every 2 hours. And what I realized was that our fundamental understanding of what is metabolism, it's pretty limited just in the scope of what we think we know versus how complex it truly is and how much we really do know if we look into it. So your metabolism, the way most people think of it, we're really talking about your metabolic rate or generally how many calories your body burns in a given period of time doing what it does. The cool thing is we've managed to break this down, specifically where are the majority of these calories being burned? Who are the energy hogs in your body? And it's generally your vital organs, right? Your heart, your liver, your brain, your kidneys, your GI tract. Very, very important things. So if your metabolism were to slow massively in a 2 to 3 hour period because you did not eat, we would have a reason for a large amount of concern because one of those major organs obviously wouldn't be working as efficiently as it should. It would be using less energy. It would have slowed down. Something would be wrong. And you can imagine how fragile we'd be as a species is if you missed a meal, a scheduled meal that happens every 2 hours, that you were able to crash and damage an organ to the degree where it would show up in your metabolic rate. And that's when I really realized, I'm like, oh, okay. This whole metabolism metabolic rate thing may not be as fragile and as prone to extreme fluctuations as I've been led to believe. So yeah, when everybody kind of brings up the metabolism thing, but after a while, when you look at it, you're like, okay, it makes sense. It wouldn't shift that quickly. Yeah.
So a lot of the understanding may come across to some folks as, say, an advanced tactic, even when it comes to a nutritional philosophy or a lifestyle, when in fact, I certainly believe and you purport in your research and findings that no, we all can benefit, everyday people can benefit from this. when did you really kind of first discover that, yeah, this isn't just about, you know, a tactic for, say, bodybuilders or elite athletes, but that, you know, everyone can benefit from this? And how do you go about really persuading everyday people that might not have the most conducive lifestyles to consider trying this?
A couple of easy things there is I realized it was applicable to your average person when halfway through designing or working with this, we moved away from the idea of every other day fasting to once or twice a week. And then, you know, trying to determine that once or twice a week, you know, what do we tell people? Should it be every third day, every fourth day, every 70 hours? Like, how do we do this? And then we kind of came up with the idea just, you know, with myself and my colleague John Barbin sitting over coffee going, like, what if we don't tell them when? What if we just say once or twice a week, non-consecutive days? And what we realized is that opened up a world of flexibility for the average person where they don't live in a gym or they're not a student where they can really play with their life, you know, and the structure of their days. But when they're a, you know, a 30-something young mom who absolutely positively can't, you know, possibly think about dieting on Tuesdays because she gets home from work, she loads the kids in the car, they go to gymnastics, they go from gymnastics and they have to pick up the other kid a guitar. It's just, it's impossible for her on that day. Right. Well, then we realize, oh, then you just eat on that day and you fast on a different day where you're busy, but it's easier not to eat because the stress is lower. You can flex this diet. You can move it and change it to fit your life, especially the way it was designed where the 24-hour fast is over 2 days. So you get to pick the start and stop times. As long as you don't get too married to an idea of you always fast on Tuesdays starting at 2 p.m. exactly, as long as you keep it fluid, it becomes something that really can adjust and alter as your life adjusts and alters. And that was the sort of the grand realization that made me realize it can be applied to most people's lives is when you fight the temptation and fight all their quests to make it more rigid, you know, to tell people exactly, do I skip 2 or 3 meals? Is starting at 2 o'clock or 7 o'clock, which one is better? You know, should I fast? I fasted on Tuesday. Do I have to fast Thursday or Friday? When you resist the temptation to pull the I know everything, you know, approach and just give definite answers to those questions, but instead you say, well, do what works for you. As much as people hate that answer because it seems so wishy-washy, it is in fact what makes this diet something that most people can do and most people can do long-term. In terms of getting them to start, this is the really cool part, is that you just have to convince them to do one fast. And the really fun part is that in the 24 hours, especially for people who haven't done this ever before in their lives, people are probably going to see some weight loss. It's not all going to be fat. A lot of it is just the weight of their body with food in it versus the weight of their body without food in it. But for a lot of people, that's a little bit of motivation. That's all it takes is the holy cow, you know, I was 151 yesterday at 2 p.m. and I'm 148 today. I went down because I was fasting. Eating less does work. And then you're off to the races.
That's awesome. Yeah, that the whole the flexibility and the realistic kind of approach of eat, stop, beat is something that I think is really attractive to the average person. And it also makes you a total greatist, by the way, because it's just a really relaxed approach to health and nutrition, and it's whatever works for the person who's practicing it. But
it has to be. Even if it weren't fasting, if it were diet, I've always been confused by a diet book that says, you know, eat these specific foods. In a world where information is available worldwide, you know, you'd be telling someone in Connecticut the exact same nutrition advice as someone who lives in Shanghai, where the, you know, the food availability may be completely different. So you have to be flexible just now.
No, I completely agree. Like, since you were talking about a busy mom before, I just have to ask about women and fasting, because yep, there does seem to be a lot of, well, some evidence that fasting affects women differently. I saw one study, for instance, that said fasting works better for endurance workouts than women and weight training for men. And there are some reports that women are more sensitive to the stress of fasting than men. Like paleoforwomen.com, for instance, has a very long and angry article that says, you know, women experience anxiety and sleeplessness and irregular menstruation and so on from
fasting. Well, you have to be careful on that, because there's some very large confounders in those articles. The first is the use of the animal trials, which was unfortunately very selective. And you're going to find if you, pull the references on the mouse trials used, that there was a large difference between the control animals and the animals that were intermittently fasting. But there was no difference between the animals that were intermittently fasting and the other animals that were dieting. It just seemed to be an effect of calorie restriction in general on those animals. So it's very hard to extrapolate from a mouse to a human. It shouldn't be done, but it continues to be done. The next is when dealing with specifically the differences in genders, you have to account for known gender differences, you know, the known gender differences in substrate metabolism, the known gender differences in thyroid and insulin sensitivity. And a great example is in men, you know, men who overeat, testosterone goes down, women who overeat, testosterone goes up, right? So there's all these known effects, but then if you suggest they're unknown and then you study fasting, you know, these are sort of surprise findings that would have been otherwise, you know, obvious to anybody who looked at it and be like, yeah, but these women are losing weight. This is kind of what happens. So to sum it up, I guess, is that from what I've found, if anything, your average woman with average amount of body weight is more prone to finding better results from intermittent fasting than a man. They're more protective to a lot of the effects, or sort of they reap better responses, in fact. We do run into situations where when you're dealing with very lean women, they run into issues that have to do with their reproductive hormones. The interesting point of this is that they're very similar to the problems that happen in men. And in men who are very lean, who then continue to, whether it's intermittent fasting or dieting, continue to cut calories. The difference is women have an outstanding monthly marker, for lack of a better term, of their reproductive hormonal health. We don't have that, right? So a woman misses her period, or her period is delayed, the time between it is different, or the feeling of the period is different. She has an immediate alarm bell sensation where she can go to a doctor and be like, something's different. A guy who's already very lean, who's dieting, starts feeling kind of lethargic and doesn't have a lot of push in the gym, and he's just kind of lazy or burnt out or tired, right? So it's very rare that a man would have that feeling, then go to an endocrinologist and be like, something's not right. Like, I'd like, you know, run a full profile. I want luteinizing hormone, FSH, testosterone, estrogen, E2. I want them all done. So I think what we're seeing is not a selection bias, but maybe an awareness bias here, that with women who are very lean, who then start to run into problems, are very quick to identify that the problem seems to be in their reproductive hormones. Whereas guys who are very lean, who continue to try to lose weight by following large caloric deficits and or large amounts of exercise, tend to chalk it up to just being tired or exhausted, and they glaze by what could be the underlying problems, which again would lay down to reproductive hormones. So this, to cut this ramble short, while there are gender differences that are obvious and known, to start taking on this idea of adding diet on top of diet and workout on top of workout is not a good thing. It doesn't matter if it's intermittent fasting or adding any other form of caloric restriction or any extra form of excessive calorie burning. When you're already very, very lean, there may be consequences to that, man or woman. So I think what we saw in there is just a heightened awareness from that gender, but not necessarily a reason why they shouldn't fast any more or less than a man of equal degree of leanness should. I rambled my way through that one.
No, it's good. It accentuates the scientific side of intermittent fasting, which is, I think, essential to understanding the concept, to implementing it correctly, to maintaining that momentum. And I wonder, because there is a lot of science already out there, you've done a lot of research on it and reporting on it and examining of other studies, what are you looking at next? What are the studies that we need to do to just better understand what intermittent fasting is and how we can properly incorporate it into our healthy lifestyle?
Well, we need to look at every facet of human health and intermittent fasting. And what we have to look at then is anything new that's coming up. The next big thing in human health is obviously, to me, the gut microbiome or your gut microflora or the good and bad bacteria ratios in your body. Be very interesting to find out what different lengths and frequencies of fast, what kind of effects they have on your gut microflora. We have many, many diseases that could be considered an epidemic right now, so there's more and more work to be done on fasting. But similar to the question you had on women, the other thing we have to do is start looking at subsets of populations of different people and being like, you know, is it's going to be contraindicated for someone. I mean, we know that. At the same time, it's going to be whatever the opposite of contraindicated, super indicated for people, right? So it's important to really sort of dial into this. You know, if you're on certain medications, perhaps you shouldn't be fasting because it maybe makes the medication weaker. But if you're on other medications, maybe you should be fasting because it makes it work even better, right? If you know, cold, flu, you recovering from an injury, there's so many avenues to look at. But if we're going to promote intermittent fasting, especially the way I do, which is that it's in some shape or form probably good for a vast majority of people, there's a level of responsibility needed where, you know, I do have to keep an open mind to there's a whittling away effect at that vast majority when I'm going to have to say vast majority with the following exceptions, right? So I think that's the direction. There's no doubting the scientific accuracy and the proof in the field, so to speak, of its effects on weight loss. There's no doubting the fact that for a lot of people, it's an easier approach. So what we do have to start looking at is the possible contraindications, the possible superindications, and then like a lot of the research right now that Chris Severity is coming out with is combinations, right? So fasting and exercise, how, when, why, what's the best combination? And I don't like getting too caught up in that because ultimately the best combination is whatever you can do, right? But if you have your time and you have your choice, what's the best option? So I think that's where we need to go with research, really digging into and pulling away the people who can't fast and people who need to fast under the supervision of let's say their physician towards the people who you're going to get an amazing benefit of fasting. Areas that I'm not willing to touch, but I'm sure other people will, looking at fasting in children. It's something I simply don't discuss because it's not my area of expertise and it would be, you know, irresponsible for me to do so. But someone out there that is their area of expertise. They do need to kind of look at it so they can give people an answer because it may be beneficial, it may be not. But what I don't want to see is people getting their kids fasting just because they're fasting, right? Without realizing that a child is much different than an adult in terms of their physiology and their nutritional needs.
No, that's absolutely true. What you were saying earlier about the newer, the unstudied or the less studied effects of fasting, it made me think about a lot of things. Some of the things I've read, which isn't reported on as much as other benefits of fasting, are called autophagy, which I think the New York Times defined it as cells eating up damaged and diseased other cells like garbage disposals, which apparently lowers the risk of Alzheimer's and cancer. And I hear that fasting induces autophagy to a degree. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was one of my more interesting areas I covered. That, I think that was in the fifth update of Eat Stop Eat. When I really got onto the concept, okay, if fasting is helping with all these disease states, we don't really know how. Like, we know it's because the body's taking a break from eating and blah, 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 but there was no mechanism. And when we stumbled upon the idea of autophagy and the way the body handles, I guess, itself, it was really fascinating. So, I mean, we're incredible systems. We're incredible machines. And part of what we do that's so cool is we have a recycling component to ourselves. We tag and identify, you know, proteins and cells in our bodies that are just, they're structurally damaged, they're not working properly, they're a bit beat up. We tag them, we degrade them down to their parts, their most basic components. We get rid of those components that just aren't usable anymore, and the rest we recycle. We turn them into brand new components in our body that are fully functional, and we insert them back in. So, you know, a slightly damaged protein in your left quad can be recycled and turned into a beautifully functioning component of your heart, you know, and vice versa. And that's the entire process of autophagy. It's this cleaning up of your body. It's making sure that, you know, these damaged things don't just sort of get shut in the basement, you know, and forgotten about, right? They're sent out to be recycled and brought back in. And fasting seems to allow your body the time to do that. And the way I like to think of it is that when you're constantly eating, it's like you're constantly bringing stuff into your house, right? You have to find places for all these new things, right? Someone shows up with a couple of new lamps, you got to find a place to put them, et cetera.
Right.
And that's what you're doing that 24/7. But then all of a sudden, when people stop dropping by with new stuff for your house, you look around and you're like, I got to fix that light bulb. That light bulb's been burned out for like a week. I just haven't had a chance to get to it, right? So it gives you a chance to do that kind of stuff, you know, the housework and the maintenance work on the house. And that's kind of how your body works. If you're constantly dealing with all this influx of you've got these carbohydrates and vitamins and proteins and fats, and I got to figure out where to put them and store them. And, you know, we know that we can overburden the body because sometimes it gets so burdened, it doesn't even store fat in your typical body fat deposits. It just sticks them on the side of arteries. It's like, I will deal with you later. You know, you could get an organ. You're a bunch of fat. You're going to get stuck in your liver right now, right? So we know that it gets burdened with this job. So every once in a while, taking a break and being, you know, do what you got to do, clean up around here, is this fantastic thing that we're capable of doing. Now, like everything in our body, we wouldn't want to be doing exclusively that. So we wouldn't want autophagy, you know, turn to level 10 and then just left there for months on end. It's always about a balance with the human body. But the hypothesis is that if you're constantly eating, that balance is slightly off. And introducing brief periods of both exercise, intensive exercise, and periods of fasting allow for this period of time where our autophagy is slightly kicked up a notch, that allows it to do what it's due, then it gets toned back down again. And that's one of the really interesting benefits if you want to really take it down to that level of fasting that it can get explored more and more is the concept of autophagy and the concept of the right amount of autophagy and, you know, eventually harnessing and maybe even directing the power of autophagy and making sure we can point it to where we want it to work.
On balance, not only is balance important in terms of food consumption, essentially energy consumption, as we're discussing, but probably any principle of health striking a balance. So I wonder, you know, beyond intermittent fasting, what other habits and lifestyle changes really complement the idea of intermittent fasting to really ultimately maximize the benefits that you can reap from an intermittent fasting schedule?
The one I like, it's a very hard one to sort of to explain to people, is we are dependent, right, on the concept of a calorie, right? So the vast majority of people listening to this call or people who are into fitness and into health probably have an idea of an arbitrary number of these things you're supposed to eat, you know, 2,700 or 2,500 or 1,800, right? And it's this number. And we depend on calculators and nutrition fact panels to add up and see if we've hit this number or not. And we've almost become dependent on like a calculator mentality, right? You need to have a calculator nearby to do the math. What I'd like to take from fasting, what I think is a balanced next step, is returning to the feel of food and enough, not enough, and too much, and get back to using the principle of calories as a guide, but only to guide you to the point where you know what it feels like with a variety of foods that you eat. That was about enough, that was not enough, and that was way too much. And the cool thing is with a 24-hour fast, by the end of a fast, you will definitely get the feeling of not enough, right? That this is what not enough food feels like. Then if you're fasting twice a week, so you've got a 2 to 3 day period there where you can really practice the art of enough, right? Like I'm done for today. I had a really big breakfast, really big lunch, even though it's only about 4, I think I'm done. Or you know, I haven't had much all day, even though it's 11 at night, I can probably eat now. You know, I'm gonna have a sandwich before I go to bed because I don't think I quite feel like I've had enough. Or you recognize those days, you're like, okay, that was way too much. That was, it's time to turn this off. That was too much, and I got to really pay attention to what I do tomorrow. And I want people to be able to do that without pulling out a pen and paper and doing, okay, I had a sub for 400 calories, and I had that Frappuccino for 300, and oh, I had a shake, and that was 200, so I'm already at 1,100 for the day. The calculator said I'm supposed to eat 27. crap, so I've got 1,600 to eat. You know, that kind of that mentality where you're not depending on what's happening on in your body to tell you how much you should be eating. You're depending on a calculation. And I think it's a slippery slope, because if you trust too much in the calculator and your estimates of what you're eating, then you sit there going, well, I've eaten 2,700 calories exactly for the last 3 days, but my weight hasn't gone down, but the calculator said it should go down at 2,700, so my metabolism is broken. You know, you come to these very severe conclusions when instead you'd probably, without that calorie number and that idea that it's perfect, you would go, okay, my weight hasn't gone down in a week, so the amount I've ate this week is probably about the amount it takes to maintain this weight. So if I want to lose weight, I'm going to have to either eat a bit less than this or exercise a bit more and see what happens, right? So that in terms of enough, in terms of that concept, the concept of balance, that's where I want people to go with fasting. I want them to use a combination of fasting and calorie counting as a tool to be able to get away from being dependent on both of them and just sort of learn the concept of enough, not enough, and way too much.
That is so beautiful. This is like the best thing about following your page on Facebook as well. And everyone should like your page on Facebook, by the way, which is just facebook.com/BradPielon. Because like every other post of yours is telling people to stop worrying about how many grams of protein to eat and how many calories there are in a stick of broccoli. And basically how you think health and fitness should have fewer rules, not more, which I think is a really good approach. Similarly, this is, you know, I've noticed there's a lot of like Zen philosophy in Eat, Stop, Eat, if you don't mind my saying. Even at the conclusion of Eat, Stop, Eat, you appropriated this famous Zen saying, saying, before you study nutrition, food is food and drink is drink. And while you're studying nutrition, food is no longer food and drink is no longer drink. But once you have enlightenment, food is once again food and drink is once again drink. And there's this really like Zen current underpinning a lot of your writing. Do you think this is a bit of a weird question. Do you think Zen has a place in the health and fitness space?
Yeah, there is. One of the biggest influences in my life would be the book Tao of Pooh by Benjamin Hoff. And I turn back to that book occasionally to be, you know, can we slow it down? Can we break it down? I always think of like, you know, people were successful at both gaining weight and losing weight before we broke down food into its chemical constituents, right? And then we always turn to this idea of breaking it down and learning more and more about food to solve our problems with food. And I'm not always sure that's the right way to go about it. That quote, by the way, it really sums up my personal feelings about nutrition. Because, you know, when I really got into the idea of nutrition and bodybuilding, et cetera, I mean, I must have been 6 or 7 years old. And that, honestly, my influence was Lou Ferrigno playing The Incredible Hulk on TV.
Right.
That was it. I was just like, wow, that guy is big. He's muscular. He transformed. It was really cool. I can't get my hands on gamma rays, but I bet you I can do that by eating bananas, right? Like it was just sort of, you know, you knew you're supposed to eat food and you know, your parents kind of helped guide you along the way. Your grandparents especially were there for the, you know, your green beans helped to grow, that kind of old school traditional mentality. Back when food was just, you know, food. I remember my grandfather told me I was supposed to eat oatmeal because it sticks to your bones, right? Like just simple stuff like that. And then, you know, years and years later, I'm not only have I studied nutrition in school, but now my entire job in research and development for a supplement company is to break a food down to its active components to try to find the best active component to freeze, dry, process, and put in a pill. And it just sort of, it really got to me when I was looking at the ingredient list of what, you know, potential new weight loss supplements. And I'm like, well, okay, that's from cumin, and that's from broccoli, and that's from red wine, and that's actually from a button mushroom. I'm like, oh, that would be a start to a pretty cool meal, right? And I realized, I'm like, wow, I've lost any connection with food. I can tell you the fatty acid composition of peanut butter, right? But I don't even know if I like peanut butter. I'm like, I swear I used to. I swear that my comfort food growing up was peanut butter and honey on toast. But now, you know, I look at everything for the components within it. It hasn't really made me any better at this. You know, I'm not as knowledgeable as I was. It's not like you know, I was the healthiest person in the world. Someone didn't come to my door one day, knock on it, and give me a healthy person award, right? For like, wow, we've measured everybody, and you're by far healthier and happier than anybody else on the planet because of your awesome knowledge. And, you know, like, if I were just to go back to really eating the food because I enjoyed it, eating it because of a celebration, eating with some responsibility, would I be less healthy? Or would I just be a little bit more happier with my food choices? And that entire sort of poem, or whatever you will call that poem thingy, it really defined that for me. Because when I went back to just sort of, okay, I'm going to use fasting to maintain my weight, and then I'm going to eat responsibly. And anybody who thinks that when I say eat responsibly means that I just say you can go out and eat Twinkies all day is delusional, because you're missing out on the vastness of the tastes that are available to you. But, you know, to never have a really good pad thai because there's noodles in it, to me, is just crazy, right? Because I don't have a gluten sensitivity or allergy, so why would I miss out on the phenomenal flavors in pad thai, or the flavors in a really good Indian dish? Or, I mean, the other day, so I was telling you guys before, I live just north of Hamilton, and in this little town called Dundas, it's far away from me, there's a place called Beater Monkey that makes their own chocolate. And they have a chocolate that's a cumin-infused chocolate. I mean, it's mind-blowing, right? Known, because I wouldn't have ever tried it before, right? Because A, it's chocolate, and chocolate's bad for you, and I'm not so sure about cumin. But if you just open up to all the flavors and variety, there's so much more to do with food. And end of day, I'm not any less healthy because I had a chocolate with some cumin in it, right? Than if I just never had it because I was opposed to chocolate because it's bad for you. So that poem means a lot. It's why... You know, it was kind of risky in a book that's a 300 reference long sort of scientific paper to end it with a Zen poem, but it was in there for a reason. That was kind of my own little personal touch in terms of the journey I had to go through to be able to write that book.
Food is sort of a Zen experience. Maybe cultures outside the U.S. are a bit better at it in terms of it being more of an experience to take longer at meals. It becomes, you know, an event, not just, you know, kind of, you know, rushing from meeting to meeting and trying to quickly catch up on a meal. So I wonder, sort of, to blend the idea of a almost meditative experience plus the culinary interest that a lot of people have, and I do as well, what sort of a diet maybe aligns better to intermittent fasting? And paleo, of course, comes to mind first, in part because I am a believer in sort of the science behind it. And it would seem to suggest that some of the stuff that I've read, say, largely through Mark Sisson, that sort of the evolutionary idea of paleo, that, you know, our bodies have evolved in a certain way and that we should continue to feed ourselves consistent with that, maybe aligns a little more closely with intermittent fasting, because that also seems to have been a more kind of prehistoric or pre-modern day human lifestyle choice.
Yeah, the thing I like most about paleo, and the one, I mean, there's so many arguments now about what is paleo and what's not paleo. From my understanding of our ancestors, and the one that I'm going to romantically hold on to, is the one thing they did well is they dined together, right? And I remember being out with, again, with my colleague John Barbin, and every once in a while he says something really profound. This is one of those times. And, you know, we were sitting there, and I'm trying to figure out something to write, and I just look up at him, like, dude, what's the biggest mistake people are making in nutrition? You know, in this typical silly way, he looks up and he's like, nobody dines anymore. They just eat. No one dines. And he just goes back to doing whatever he was doing. And I was like, that was pretty profound, because we don't dine anymore, right? And food, I mean, if anything, from a paleo point of view, was this thing where you shared it with a tribe, where you dined. It was a reason to get together. It was a reason to celebrate. It was a reason to sit and communicate. And so the food was part of a larger process. And I think that's something that we've lost, and I don't think we've lost it too far ago. I mean, my grandparents were big believers in, you know, the family dinner, the dining, and I think there's a lot of cultures that still hold on to that as well. But we've replaced that because we're so busy with fueling, you know, if not even just eating, but now it's fueling, right? You're like, I'm hungry, I gotta grab something, I'm already late for work, okay, I'm gonna get a coffee and a donut and go. And then you're sitting in your car and you're like, where'd I put the donut? You're like, oh, I ate it already. God, I don't even remember tasting it, right? So we've lost that principle. So I do think that if parts of the paleo philosophy that really gel with the fasting philosophy is there's times to not eat And there's times to eat. And when you do eat, the traditional way to do it is with other people, kind of as a celebration, a reason to get together and take it slow.
I love it. and it's interesting because Matt was just saying that he's interested in fasting as it relates to a paleo diet, whereas I spent 3 years following Eat Stop Eat on a vegetarian diet.
Oh, nice.
I really think it's flexible and it can work for everyone. But more importantly, I think the main conclusion of all of it should be that we should eat mindfully. And the way it relates to Zen is that we should just do everything mindfully, right? But in a more health and fitness specific sense. Once you do bring mindfulness to how you eat, you find yourself you overeat less and you enjoy your food a lot more.
Yeah, and then the idea of dieting too and being mindful, it gives you permission to wait, right? So I mean, it's 2 p.m. my time right now. It's Thursday night, so it's date night. So I'm going out with my wife for dinner tonight. So I know I'm going to eat tonight. Like there's not a question in my mind that at some point tonight food will be made available to me. So I'm not in a rush to stuff myself right now because I know that there's going to be a pretty good meal tonight. And that permission to wait, that little pause, it means a lot to a number of people because they've been taught that's not okay, right? And I remember once waiting for a friend of mine to come meet me for lunch. This was back when I was working in an office space. And everybody's going out for lunch, and my buddy was caught in traffic, and so I was waiting on her. And the receptionist at the time was like, well, you should at least run out and grab something to tide you over. And I thought, oh, that's a great idea. I should run out and grab something. And I thought, wait, why? Why am I doing that again? I'm about to have dinner. I mean, lunch. We're going to an awesome restaurant. You know, it's not more than 45 minutes until I'm eating. Why should I tide myself over? But people have that mentality, this go, 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 feed, feed, feed mentality, where you're really not allowed to just sort of wait until the good meal comes. And I think that's something that when you do start eating mindfully, paleo, vegan, vegetarian, everythingism, it allows you to wait for the good meal, I guess, is sort of the key point.
So maybe then end on another fun note, and it extends the idea of food consumption 1 degree further and one, I guess, level deeper, which is alcohol. And yeah, a lot of people have commitments around alcohol as it pertains to a certain diet pattern, a certain lifestyle choice, and then certainly now in this context, intermittent fasting. So I love scotch, and I think we've come to learn that you like single malts as well. So how do you see alcohol fitting into the philosophy? And then what region do you most enjoy when it comes to scotch?
Oh, you're a good man. All right, so first off, I divide my scotches up into their price ranges. So for under $1, U.S. Canadian, because they're about at par. I like some of the Glenmorangie specialty scotches, the Solera Reserve, the Nectar d'Or, those ones. For over 100, but not above 200, Highland Park 18 is hard to beat. It's a beautiful, beautiful scotch. And then once you go over 200, then you start breaking into personal tastes. And then it's important for a lot of people who aren't full-on scotch people to know is that older doesn't necessarily always mean better. It depends on your taste. As an example, and to my friends at Highland Park, and you know who you are, I like the 18 better than the 21. I won't lie here. But yeah, so if you're out buying for Christmas and you've got a buddy who's a scotch drinker, you know, and if you want to get he or she something under $100, you know, try out the Glenmorangie. But if they're good people or you want to have a good scotch at their house for you to drink, which is what I do, buy them the Highland Park 18. And that way, no matter whose house you go to, you know you've got a drink, right? So those are my faves. There's a bunch of other ones that I always like playing with right now, but those are kind of the go-tos. How they fit into intermittent fasting is that, well, first off, intermittent fasting forces you once or twice a week to not drink. I'm not that bad, but I like thinking of it that way. But it is a time to just abstain from everything. And that, to me, that really does include scotch and Guinness, which is my stout of choice. And as much as I've tried to find a way to rationalize drinking during the fast, it's hard to do, right? It's very hard to sort of come up with a reason other than I really, really want to. But that's an important lesson because I think for a lot of people, adding things into your fast, you know, while we're trying to do it because of the abundance of scientific research, you really have to make sure you're not adding it in just because you really, really, really want to, right? So trying to think of a reason to kind of cheat the system, make 24 hours a little bit easier, make it so that even though you're fasting, you're consuming something. It's a slippery slope where, on paper, if you and I were to sit down and do the science behind it, we might be able to find this magic calorie number, whether it's 30 or 40 calories or 50 maybe, where the fast is technically unbroken. The issue is mentally it's been broken. And the issue is then you haven't really learned to go without. You're just sort of trying to cheat your way through it. You almost become that person who just eats celery all day long type of thing. So the alcohol during a fast kind of falls into that realm for me. Is that the only reason I'd be doing it because I really want to, not because I actually did find some sort of benefit or reason why it would be okay. It's devastating to hear.
Killer. Well, all of it is great. I now have some wonderful Scotch recommendations to go investigate further. I'm certainly a Glen Moran fan to kind of put that on the table. I also visited the Isle of Skye a couple of years back, and they have some just from the Isle of Skye, and those are pretty divine. So thank you.
Go to any distilleries while you were there?
There were. I went to Tomaten, which is actually not on the Isle of Skye. That was in the Highlands in Scotland, which was not only just fun to obviously have a bit of a taste test, but to just see the process. And the countryside is just gorgeous. So if any travel aficionados are out there as well, you can enjoy some beautiful scenery and a good scotch if you go to the Highlands. So I certainly recommend it.
That's where I did my honeymoon. True story.
Excellent.
Yeah.
This has been fantastic, Brad. Nick, any kind of concluding thoughts or questions?
I think I like the way that all ended, that in the end, fasting is about exercising your willpower muscle rather than any other muscles, and that might be the most important thing to take away from it.
Yeah. I mean, that's what eating is, right? It's just sort of turning it back into conscious decisions of who's in control here. I guess control is even the word, but I guess it's more like, can I wait? When do I want to eat? And once you sort of have the ability to make that decision, it just becomes a lot easier.
An end of mindless eating.
Yeah, there you go, which was the title of a great book, by the way.
Oh, good. I'll look it up.
So, Brad, where can folks learn more about you, learn more about Eat, Stop, Eat, and your philosophies?
Yeah, okay. So I'm active on Twitter. I like the 140-character limit. It keeps me from rambling, as everybody now knows I'm prone to doing. So I'm on Twitter, just at Brad Pilon. I'm also on Facebook, and I'm there fairly regularly. I like Facebook because I like the way you can interact with people. So that's just, I guess, facebook.com/Brad Pilon. I have my blog, which is bradpilon.com. I sound very narcissistic right now.
No, it's good. It's good. We need people to be able to engage, and people want to, so this is excellent.
Yeah, and the blog is ramblier. It's a thought where I like to think out loud in writing. So a lot of times what you'll be reading on the blog is me, myself, working my way through a problem. So for people who like that approach and that process, the blog can be entertaining. And then, as always, if you're just more interested in Eat, Stop, Eat and want to know the science behind it, and that's just eatstopeat.com.
Wonderful.
Excellent. Well, thank you again, Brad. This has been such a delight. If you like the show, definitely check us out on iTunes. Leave us a comment in the iTunes. Rate us if you enjoyed this conversation with Brad. So, Brad, thank you so much again, and have a wonderful day.
Yeah, you both of you have a thing as well.
Thanks a lot for your time, Brad.
The Greatest Podcast is part of the NerdQuest Podcast Network. To check out all our other great shows, including the freelancing show Nerds for Hire, go to nerdquest.com.